project management is the death of good product marketing. Being, you know, we can become glorified project managers if we're not careful and not making sure spend the time and the energy on the creative output and the actual strategy. That's where people get themselves into a ton of trouble and also kind of lean into the project management almost too much, I would say.
So many companies out there just cherry pick the craziest outlier performers for their customer proof. So what I want is a realistic, you know, expectation on what can your product actually do.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Product Marketing Life podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. In this episode, I got a chance to sit down with the boys behind User Evidence, Mark Huber and Alex Eaton. Mark peeled back the curtain a bit on his first PMM hire, Alex, and Alex shared what it's been like building his PMM charter for User Evidence. And then we took some time to talk about what User Evidence does best, customer proof. Mark has been a longtime marketing hero of mine, so I really enjoyed this episode, and I think you will too.
The boys of User Evidence, how are you guys?
Might have to stick with that. That's a nice little intro. I'm doing well. How are you, Colin?
I'm doing really well. Have you guys gotten any other titles internally now that there's two marketers at UE?
The only funny thing that happened was those branded headshots that we use on LinkedIn, Alex had his old headshot and then we had him use his new headshot on Slack. And then in group conversations with Alex, myself, and then anyone else, if Alex and I were both in there, it was like way too confusing to see who was who. So I made him change it. Or actually, I think you changed it back on your own.
Yeah, can't tell us apart. And we can't have that in the conversations. I couldn't tell whose face was who. So we had to fix that quickly.
As if the mustache wasn't a dead giveaway, but that's another conversation.
But I was experiencing that messaging you guys on LinkedIn. Like you have that branded background and from afar, it's just two white dudes in a lot of purple.
I know. Yeah. So you basically saw the same exact thing just in LinkedIn.
Just in the LinkedIn capacity. And, you know, this is a particularly fun one for me because, Mark, I mean, you know this, but I've been following what you've been up to for a while since your metadata days. I remember binging Demand Gen U while like painting my son's nursery. So this is just like a really fun experience on that front.
You couldn't find anything more exciting to listen to?
I don't know. I think I might just be at a different capacity of nerddom to think like
that. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Do you listen to Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert?
So my girlfriend Courtney got me hooked on that. It is so funny, although I'm a little selective over which ones I listen to. And if I know, like, if I like the guest, I will absolutely listen to it. It's so funny.
Yeah. So for me, my appetite or like my diet of podcasts is B2B.
Yep.
And that basically is like what I'm taking in most of the time. And so Alex, I feel like I became aware of you in part because I applied for the job you got. So that's a fun aspect.
Oh man.
And that is still, I will say to your credit, Mark, that is still the most fun I've had in an interview process. Cause I feel like we kind of just got to talk shop. And I think kind of some of the approach that UE has taken, I feel a kindred spirit with. So I knew that whoever you brought on was going to be high caliber. So Alex, it's cool to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Happy to be here.
So I know that hot takes are a big User Evidence value, and I want to make you guys feel at home with what you're doing at the Proof Point. So I wanted to start in the spirit of Proof Point with what are your two biggest product marketing hot takes?
Alex, I'm going to give you this one first just because I hired you to own product marketing while I think of what my hot take is.
Yeah, I don't know how hot it is when you really think about it, but the thing that keeps coming back to me is that project management is the death of good product marketing. And I think that when you get, it's so easy for us to get caught in just managing everything, pushing projects forward, the like mechanics of the job, that you end up getting to, you have a half hour left before a deadline. You're like, oh, I need to write the whole landing page. I actually need to write copy now. And you have no energy left. You have nothing left for the actual work that you're going to be judged for at the end of the day. So I think that getting caught in that cycle of being, you know, we can become glorified project managers if we're not careful and not making sure you spend the time and the energy on the creative output and the actual strategy. That's where people get themselves into a ton of trouble and also kind of lean into the project management almost too much, I would say.
Oh, for sure. I feel like a little part of me dies every time I hear a job description where it's like, we're looking for someone who's part strategist, part project manager. And yeah, like I get, you should be reasonably organized. Like I'm here for that, for product marketing, but for sure, otherwise you just kind of devolve into managing that everyone else gets their part of the go-to-market motion done. And that sucks. That's just not, it's not what you signed up for. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Right, Mark, did that give you enough time?
I don't know if this is a hot take. I feel like it is, but it's where my mind immediately went. I feel like most marketing leaders that don't come from product marketing backgrounds just straight up don't understand product marketing. And when people are trying to make the case to hire for a product marketer, they continually get shut down. And then when it finally comes around to get approval for the role, they're like, all right, let's hire a product marketer. And by that point, there's just been so much product marketing debt that's accumulated that it's almost like impossible to make up all of that ground.
Yeah. That's an interesting, I mean, I think you're right. I think that's an accurate read of the landscape. It's either that, or I feel like because product marketing has gotten some traction, you'll have a CEO who thinks, oh, we got to get a product marketer in there. And they're excited about the concept, but they still have no freaking clue of like what a product marketer is supposed to do. They just, I don't know, someone told them like that's supposed to be your first marketing hire.
Well, and I don't want to steal Alex's thunder because I know that we'll talk about this soon, but I think part of the reason why is there's just so many different definitions of what product marketing is. And I just think it's confusing to some degree when you're not doing what Alex is doing here.
Lately, I've been thinking that eventually product marketing is going to get split into multiple roles. And that is what it should be at the end of the day, like based on where it lives, because it's just too broad. Like it's way too broad. There's too much going on. And as we talked about, like building the charter and things here, I feel like we're going to end up splitting like market side versus product side. It'll be some sort of product growth role or something that is like the folks who live in product and focus specifically there. I could very much see a world where it gets split into two instead of one role to do everything. Maybe that's odd.
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate because I interviewed at a company and they were starting to peel back the curtain on how their team was structured. And that's essentially how they structured it. They had product marketers and then go-to-market product marketers, essentially, that they used maybe different terminology, but that was essentially the two buckets. Like they had a whole team of three or four who stayed really close to the product. And then another three or four who were really just thinking about go-to-market, what gets pushed out in the wild, that sort of thing. There's probably a case to be made too for, I mean, sales enablement sometimes gets rolled up into product marketing, competitive gets rolled up into product marketing. So yeah, I think you're onto something there.
Yeah. There could be focuses on each side though, right? Like there's the product side of sales enablement, but then there's the go-to-market side of sales enablement. And same thing with competitive. You're looking at feedback, like, you gotta work together, but the way in which the work actually happens day to day, I do think is different enough that it could at some point be split up.
Yeah. Mark, you hinted at this a little bit, but you spent about 8 months based on my quick LinkedIn math as a solo marketer, a user evidence, and eventually arrived at this conclusion that your first hire was going to be a product marketer. And I feel like there's a lot of debate. Some people argue you need to hire a generalist or you need to hire a demand person because you're building demand for your new product. Could you kind of walk me through a little bit how you landed on hiring a product marketer first and then what you looked for in that product marketer? And you can just use this to gas up Alex if you want. Like that's fine.
He's got enough air in his tires. He doesn't need to be like overinflated right now. So I would say a couple things. So in between Metadata and that, well, I guess I was still at Metadata, but as I started to interview for gigs and then ultimately get linked up with Evan as a first call and kind of going through that interview process, I just reflected a lot of, hey, if I were to do things all over again at Metadata, what would I do differently? And I think one of the roles that I truly tried to hire for earlier on was product marketing, but it kept getting shot down. Now, part of that was because I think I maybe didn't do the best job of articulating why we needed a dedicated product marketer. I think part of that, and I would say this if he were on this podcast, and maybe you have him on at some point and check me on this. Like I would say this if Jason were here. I also don't think that he really understood what product marketing was. And he just thought you could demand gen or math your way out of a pipeline problem. And like, yeah, you can kind of do that at times, but it's really just a flash in the pan thing. And it's not building like a very solid, sturdy foundation. So I knew that when I took this role, the three priorities that I had were lay a product marketing foundation, start to then focus on content. And then once I got to that point, then we could start to worry about demand gen. So when I got the basically scenario to plan for late last fall, it was, all right, there's a chance that you get two roles, but you know, probably it's going to be one role. So I said, all right, if it's one role and one role only, it's going to be a product marketer. And here's why. And I think Evan and Ray, just being somewhat new to B2B marketing, I really had to make my case as to why a product marketer made the most sense. And I still to this day don't think that they were fully on board with it, but they trusted me, which is awesome, because now that Alex has been here for what, like this is start of week eight, I think, Alex? Yeah, 2 months. They've said to me privately a couple times, like, oh, this was the perfect role to hire for. Like, this is, we're so happy Alex is here. So it makes more sense now. But again, I think it's because product marketing is encompasses so many different things, and it's just tough to define unless you really, really know your stuff. And I think I did a better job of defining it the second time around.
Yeah. I think I like that dynamic that you're describing, because I think it's proving true that a lot of times when companies hire someone for demand or they put all their money into demand, they do have this really quick swell, and probably because of a little bit of disproportionate investment in demand compared to product category and even like awareness of the category, that sort of thing. Do you think you see that bearing repeating in other orgs, or do you feel like that's an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I think it's an accurate assessment, but I think also it's like, you know, your demand gen team, agency, function, whatever you want to call it, is only going to be successful if they have really good foundational things to use in their campaigns. And when I say foundational things to use, it's the positioning, it's the messaging, it's the value props, it's like everything that you would include in a messaging framework. And when you have that stuff really, really solid, and that's why I hired Alex to take it to the next level. I don't want to say demand gen gets easier, but they're like not working nearly as hard to just like just scrape and figure out what they should be talking about in campaigns and ads.
No, for sure. If you have that strong clarity on this is our product, this is the category we play in, this is how we're going to win and how we're differentiated, I feel like you've just given a springboard of content for all of your go-to-market teams.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And we don't have that, you take on, I like your verbiage of like product marketing debt. I don't think a lot of people talk about that. So, I mean, on that note, Alex, it's been a lot of fun just kind of watching via LinkedIn, you start to lay those foundations. And I think it is smart of Mark to say, like, we're not going to acquire a bunch of this debt and make sure that like early in UE's life. I know you guys have been around for a while, but I feel like the last year is when on a public platform level, people are becoming aware of you. Something, Alex, that you were talking about recently was laying a PMM charter. And I think this is brilliant. I've done a PMM charter at two of the last companies where I was kind of that founding product marketing role. Could you, for those who aren't familiar, could you walk us through like, how do you define a PMM charter just broadly? And then what were some of your goals as you were building one out?
Yeah. The thing I like about a charter is that you can and should do it no matter how big your company is. If you're new to product marketing, you should do one in your first couple months, purely for the fact that my definition of a charter is that it's just setting expectations. That's all it is, right? It's telling people what you can expect from me and what I can expect from you. So my goals going into the charter here, especially since there was a lot of there was a couple different pieces about it for this company in particular. There was a bit of lack of familiarity with the product marketing role that we're educating against. And then also kind of a side interesting thing is that product marketing is one of our buyers. So I had to go in with, I broadened it out a lot in the deck to include a lot of just general information, trying to educate on our role outside of even what I do, just to help the team get to know our buyer better. So my explicit goals in it were really to set expectations around what I'm going to focus on, especially at first. A lot of that is what I was hired for, to clarify what teammates should come to me for. So if you're dealing with this particular issue, if you're wondering how to talk about our product, there was a list of like eight things, then you can ask Alex. And then that third piece of educating more broadly on like, what is the function? What do we typically handle? Which can get super complex fast. And there was a lot of go in there. So it was challenging in that way, just to, because we have a challenging role to describe. I thought on like splitting it up in the future. But I think it was important. That's a part of what selling into product marketing and being product marketing is the complexity in choosing where to focus. So even though this could very well change, and I will be updating this, or at least letting the team know on a quarterly basis. I think quarterly is what makes sense, because you're taking on new projects. You're, you know, kicking, we're doing a kickoff today for Q2 for us. And it's going to be, here's what I'm focused on. Here's what you can expect from me this quarter. And if that's changing from what was in the initial charter, that's your opportunity to update that.
Yeah. And to start, did you, I mean, just to get really practical, did you walk the entire team through this at an all hands, or go to the individual go-to-market teams? How did you disperse that information out?
I also have a follow-up question after Colin that I'm going to ask Alex, even though this is not my podcast. So Alex, you have two questions coming at you. Bye.
You're welcome to.
Yeah, it was its own meeting to the entire team. So, and you know, that's not a crazy amount of people at this point, but we took a full hour to walk through the whole thing. It definitely took me the full hour. And, you know, it was more go-to-market focused naturally because of that. And because they're one of our buyers, or we are one of our buyers, but, the whole purpose was for the whole team, because I'll talk to product and work with engineering and on the go-to-market side as well, that they understand, what's going on. And I think there's value for that in every team, because product marketing works with every team. Like, our most important job is to be able to work with every team. So I think setting those expectations on either side, and I explicitly said in the charter of, I'm not focused as much on the product relationship at first. Like, I work with our product team still, and I will consistently, but the initial problems I was hired for and the things that we're focused on these first quarter or two are very much go-to-market focused. So we know we're going to come back and spend time on that, you know, in the next quarter or two. But it was good to clarify with the team of, hey, here's where my energy is going first.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Because given when I've been in the kind of Series A early startup role, I do think you skew go-to-market, or you kind of skew towards hanging out with those members. I'm in a bigger company now, and we're launching kind of a new line of products, and I feel like I'm hanging out with product all the time. So I think even setting that expectation, like, hey, I'm going to sit this intersection of all four of these roles, but even laying out, given our business, this is where I'll hang. Mark, I'm curious what your question was.
Yeah. So I'll get into that in a second, but I think the coolest thing was, I thought it was a really great idea that Alex came up with to do this at User Evidence and put it into his, I think it was it your 30 or 60 day plan?
Yeah, it was one of those.
One of the two.
It was early.
And the feedback that I was getting from people who were attending as Alex was talking, and even afterwards from leadership, like, it was amazing. So it was very, very well received. So Alex, question for you. I don't think I've asked you this before. When you posted about this on LinkedIn, did you at all think that it was going to land as well as it did? And then some, like, the response was outrageous.
Yeah, absolutely not. I've just kind of started posting on LinkedIn. It's a fun opportunity for me, because I get to connect with other folks in my discipline, and because that's our audience as well.
Well, there's another reason why too. So why don't you share that reason?
Because we sell into product marketing?
No. What did Evan tell you?
Oh, the challenge. Yeah. So in one of my final interviews, I get on, it's like the first thing we talk about is with Mark and Evan, our CEO. And the very first, I'm like prepared for, like, you know, hard hitting questions. And the first thing he asked me is, like, why do you only have 700 followers on LinkedIn? And I was completely thrown off. And no good answer. I was like, because I don't use it. So now I've taken it as a personal vendetta to pass him as fast as I can. Which is going to be an uphill battle, because he's in the game as well. But yeah, that's I'm doing it purely out of spite now at this point, though, for sure.
I think there's a healthy dose of ego that we could just let you do your best work. And that's an asset for Mark. If Alex's ego is stoked and followers go up and UE gets more brand exposure,
that's perfect.
Is there a wager? Like, if you hit that mark, you pass up either Mark or Evan and count.
Yeah, he's doing some sort of public admission. We haven't nailed it down yet. I'll probably try and get him to do something more embarrassing at that point. But no, it's yeah, it's a friendly wager. And the thing about it, though, with posting and kind of leading back to the charter is I think we all look at LinkedIn a lot of times and just cringe, and it's well known at that point. And that the part of me looks at that and just like, shrivels up thinking about it. So my goal and why the charter thing was interesting is I don't want to just be speaking platitudes and to be, you know, saying general things that everyone can agree with or going viral for whatever. The charter was interesting because I actually shared the actual deck that the actual work that I produced for the team. Like I literally didn't take a single thing out of the deck that the team saw. So it was fully transparent. And then I made the mistake of not just sharing it in the comments. I sent it to everyone individually, and I had sent it out to at least 50 people who asked for it, which was really cool. But I also think shows that there's kind of a craving for people to see what is actually going on and, you know, actual tactical, like what our role looks like in the day to day. That was cool to see, honestly.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, Mark, that confirms your hot take earlier that I think product marketers feel like people don't get their role. And that's a thing that PMA talks about a lot, is that product marketing is misunderstood. And I think there's this craving of how do I get everyone on the same page with what to expect of me? And how do I make sure I don't fall into like, I'm just like the slide deck monkey, or like I'm the battle card, like churn or something like that. And having it where everyone can actually understand what I do here. So you can actually do the product marketing stuff, you know, like do the things that you're actually excited about. So I'm not surprised you got that kind of traction, because I think there is demand for it. And I think people were naturally just, you started posting what, a month prior. And I feel like you've kind of already developed people who are like very keen to see what you do. So anyway, I'm not surprised, but it was impressive, no doubt.
It's scary in a way too, though, right? Because I started sending that deck out, and then there's still that part of, you know, we have years of experience, right? We've been doing this job, but there's still that part of you that's like, what are like my peers actually going to think of this? Is this what everyone else is doing? You know, what is that going to look like? So some of the responses to that, and it actually is a great, like that I think is going to be the most powerful part of LinkedIn. Selfishly for me, is if we can continue being transparent, and we've got some really interesting stuff we're going to share on the messaging and positioning work we've done coming up about how I almost ruined everything and made it bad and how we fixed it. But showing that work, I think, and being able to kind of have the public feedback zone from your peers is one of the coolest parts about all of it. That's what I'm looking forward to. And it requires that little extra touch of vulnerability that, you know, can freak you out a little bit. But I think that's where the real power of that place is going to come into play and be, one, just more interesting and fun and exciting, because the DM conversations you have are then much more explicit about the role and interesting and sharing good ideas versus just, you know, just hyping each other up or just trying to get more followers than your CEO.
Yeah. Just agree. support emojis. Yeah.
Thoughts. Yeah. Like I'm waiting for that person to be like, no, this sucks. Like that's I'm curious. I want that conversation to start happening too. Like I completely disagree with what you did.
I've gotten a few of those over the last year or two. So if you keep talking enough, I'm confident you'll get someone. Come.
And it's like, and this is totally unscripted, but Colin, I don't know if you felt the same way the first time that happened to you, but the first time it happened to me like years ago, I took it really personal. I was like, is this like an attack on me? Like, do I really not know what I'm talking about? Like, where did this come from? And I think the more that you take a stand for whatever you believe in marketing and really anything in life, like you're going to piss people off. And I'd rather have you piss people off because they disagree with your POV, which I think is the next thing you want to talk about, because that means it's strong and it's like a good POV, not for everybody.
Yeah. That's thank you for that tee up, Mark. It's almost like you've hosted some podcasts before. So yeah, I mean, on that note, something I've loved from User Evidence from day one is that you all have taken a strong point of view. I remember being in my last role and I was essentially trying to advocate for our company taking a really strong point of view. We put a few posts out there that got explosive comment sections. I had someone say, I love this because I disagree with everything you're saying, like on our CEO's post. But I think it's such a value. And as I was trying to build this case, I remember taking a screenshot of one of Mark's posts beating up on case studies. It's kind of the status quo you guys beat up on in some ways. And when I look at your site, I feel like you all lead with that point of view on, hey, buyers don't trust software vendors and what they have to say about themselves. And that paves the way for user evidence to say, you can get raw customer proof. So I would love to, if you can, can you peel back the curtain on how you landed on that point of view? I would be curious, like the process of arriving at that and how you decided, like, this is the stake we're going to put in the ground.
Yeah. So the process is hilarious because what happened was, and I'll tell the Cliff Notes version of this, but when I got the gig in that final interview presentation, I had to present what we were going to do and not going to do in my first 6 to 12 months. And the first three things were, don't do a rebrand, don't redo the website, and then don't spend money on paid ads. And Evan kind of, like, I don't know, he had a grin on his face in the interview. And I was like questions, comments. He's like, I agree with you, but we just raised our Series A and have to announce it before the end of the summer. So, like, you're going to have to do all of this. So it was the most expedited process ever. And really, I just thought of, like, myself as a B2B marketer and how I feel personally about vendors. And then I talked to a handful of our customers and then a couple other B2B marketers that I trust. I thought it was the best possible POV that I could have put together in the ridiculous time frame that I had. Like, we're talking weeks here. And the funny part is, I think it was too almost like thoughtful. And Alex will back me up on this here, because we've been doing a loss analysis project and we actually heard the same thing in some of these loss interviews too. So I love that you love it. I thought that it was great given all things considered and the constraints that we had, but, like, we're still working on leveling this thing up.
Yeah. When you say that, are you saying that it was too safe? Do you feel like there was Anthony Pieri talks about having like a spiky point of view.
Yep.
Is that kind of what you're saying? Is, like, there was more that could have been, more boundaries that could have been pushed?
Yeah. I don't know if it was too safe. And I'm curious, Alex, what you think about this, because we've talked about this a little bit. I just think that it was too, almost like intellectual to a degree. It wasn't, like, simple enough for the everyday marketer to understand and kind of relate to.
Yeah. The high level of it is great, right? We want to have a movement that we push towards that like substantiates the problem that we're speaking to. But when you're in the tactical side of a deal or solving a problem that someone's going to make a purchase to fix, you know, at the end of the day, are you actually buying trust? Like, is that how this action is working? The answer is a lot of times no, right? They're solving a very specific problem that is a level or two levels lower. So it's a really valuable POV and one that won't stop for sure. But I think tactically, when it comes to, like, our funnel and our messaging within it, there's going to be, you know, changes and shifts to make sure that that high level idea still leads down to an actual business problem that we're solving.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I do think you're right, because there's a way that you stay at this ethereal idea of trust, which is a little bit abstract. And you're trying to bridge that gap from, we started our problem in a more conceptual arena, and how do we bring now down the solution to a very practical, we're selling you something. And that gap's complicated, but I don't think insurmountable. Anyway, that's for you guys to workshop. I'll be curious to see where you go with it. You know, on that note of customer proof, I feel like it would be amiss just to not ask you guys a little bit more about your thinking on this. So every marketing team that I've ever been on is in some way working on customer proof. They're spinning up case studies and quotes and testimonials. And I mean, even I'm on a bigger team now and we ship a feature and the customer marketer's peppering me asking, like, do we have a case study for this? Or do we have a customer who said something about it? And so, to your point though, buyers don't trust what we have to say most of the time. If it's polished and it comes from us, it's immediately kind of received with skepticism. So what do you two think makes for customer proof that is actually convincing? It's actually believable.
So I can get us started. So I would say, you know, being in B2B marketing, we all kind of know or probably have worked on creating customer proof at the end of the day. So we know how the process works. You go into Salesforce or HubSpot, you found the outlier
you know, success stories and just the crazy stats. And then you go write a case study. Usually you write the entire thing, you send it over, they make some edits or just say, yeah, it looks great. And then you publish it. And I think what I've learned over the years is so many companies out there just cherry pick the craziest outlier performers for their customer proof. So what I want is a realistic, you know, expectation on what can your product actually do. And when you see like what we can do with user evidence, when it's an aggregate of your, you know, end users and customers, and you can kind of see, all right, maybe not every single customer saw 7,000% increase in ROI or whatever stat it is, but maybe on average you see, you know, a 45% increase in ROI. And this statistic was found from 300 plus end users. So it's the volume that kind of brings the, or at least increases the validity of what I'm reading. And I just like the shorter, more bite-sized social proof that isn't this like marketing fed case study that I know I've written before.
Yeah. Cause no one, if we're honest, does anyone really want to read like how Gong 3X their response rate with blah, 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 blah. Like that like crappy title formatting with, no one wants to read that.
Some companies are getting better at it. To give credit to like Mutiny, for example, they're doing a good job of turning customer stories into actual like tactical playbooks of here is how you should also do this job like explicitly and more tactfully. So I do like where that is starting to go. But yeah, like long form case studies, a lot of times it's just a checkbox and things like that. From my side of this, it's the scale is big, right? Of like, we have 100 customers who can substantiate this point. The realism of it not being 586% or whatever, but also just the relevance of the storytelling in itself, right? Like if I'm a salesperson in a deal, I need to, like the phrase that I always go back to with customer proof and just marketing in general is people like us do things like this. Like we all like to think we're very unique and special, but at the end of the day, we all fall into pretty set archetypes at the end of the day. Like I live in Colorado and as much as I'd like to think I'm unique, I very much fit into the Colorado guy stereotypes.
You got a mustache. Yeah.
It becomes way too obvious, way too quickly. But when it comes to marketing, I also like to change that phrase to say people like us buy things like this. And as marketing and salespeople, it's our job to one, not lie, but to show people that fact of like people like you do things like this and here's the success they have. So being able to provide realistic, relevant customer proof that people can trust and also as a tool for sales to have just all of these examples in the back of their head, because those are the best sales conversations where they can say, oh yeah, you're this similar company. Here's how this exact customer does this explicitly with our product, with an actual use case. The more opportunities you have for sales to be able to speak to that and have more examples of it beyond just the stats that you can put on your website, which are powerful. If they're, you know, actually verified stats, that I think is where a lot of the like second order power of this comes from, is in the actual explicit conversations day to day.
Yeah. Mark, you talked about this idea of cherry picking customer stories. And Alex, you talked about realism. And I think the thread there that I have to imagine, if this is an objection that you all get, is that there's an ingrained habit in the marketing community of grabbing whatever is the shiniest story and stat, even if it's not actually replicable or that applicable to their audience. So I'm wondering, and there's kind of a push for honesty in this, like that the underpinning that product is like you build trust by being honest. Do you get any sort of pushback from buyers who are like, I'm not willing to make that switch? Or like, how do I make this product churn out the really shiny stats? Have you guys bumped into any of that, whether psychologically or just actually in deal cycles?
Yeah. So I'll take that to start. And then Alex, you can tell me if I'm wrong, and you've earned the right to tell me if I'm wrong. So I think, yes, we do hear that. But what we can also tell people is, you know, hey, if you get, let's say, 50 something responses to a survey that you send out post completion of onboarding, and maybe there's a couple that speak to some not so good things about their experience with onboarding and customer success and you name it, just because they've given that to you in the survey does not mean you then have to publish it, but you still want to share that information with your customer success team. So I think, yes, you still want to curate the good stuff that, you know, is distributed externally, but there's just as much value in the tough love feedback that you don't want to share publicly, because then you know something's broken and you can route it to the right team.
Yep. Completely agree. Like, there's use in all of it. And I don't think anyone also expects marketing teams to start publishing a bunch of bad reviews. Like, people are realistic about the expectations there, but there is value in the other side of it that all teams can get from that.
Yeah. Though I do think, you know, I was recently talking with Jason Oakley and Aubrey Chapnick, and Aubrey was highlighting this stat from Ramp, where I think Ramp said that they claimed that their product led to a 5% decrease in savings. And Aubrey just pointed out, he's like, that's not a big stat, but it's actually kind of refreshingly believable. You know, you're like, oh, if someone claims I'm going to 2x your ROI or something stupid and absurd like that, you're not actually inclined to believe them. But I do wonder if there was this shift towards more realistic stats where it's sitting in the below 10%, you know, percentile sort of thing, or like it's like those stats that have this believability to them, if that would actually start to stand out, and if that would be, I think, probably be met with actually more purchases rather than less.
So we did that at Metadata. Jason and I were talking about this when we knew that we were going to do a Forrester TEI report. And the obvious way of doing one of those things is go find the three crazy outliers to then get interviewed for the study. And what we did was we used one outlier, one customer that was just incredibly average with our product, still seeing success, but like the average success that you can expect. And then we saw, you know, maybe we should include one who's not seeing, you know, nearly as much success, but still seeing some success. So we had one customer along kind of each, I guess, point in the performance spectrum. And we got amazing feedback for that because it was just honest. Like, every piece of software that you buy is not going to have the same outsized result at every single company. It's just, it's not real.
Yeah. I mean, given that reality of differing results, I'd be curious if you guys have thoughts on how then do you actually come out with a clear stat? So I'm dealing with this internally at my own company right now. And it's like, we just launched this feature that I work at Classy. So we build donation forms for nonprofits. And so we built this feature called Intelligent Ask Amounts that uses donor data to supply custom ask amounts for any donor who lands on a form. So like, Mark, you show up, hey, Mark, this is your profile, your giving history. Boom, here's an ask amount that actually matches you rather than 50, 100. It's like, actually, Mark gave a lot last year. So let's go 100, 200, 300, something like that. And we saw that it increased donation revenue by 11%. Like, that was the statistically significant, 150,000 sessions. Like, it's solid. But there's this hesitation, like, well, I can't guarantee that to you. And it may not do that on every campaign. And so I'd just be curious, this is kind of getting into the area of ethics and how you talk about what's true when it comes to proof. But how do you all navigate and account for varying results when you actually publish a stat about how a product performs?
All right, Alex, I have an idea, but you go first and I'll tell you.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind for me is being honest in the way you actually ask the question. That means that your answers can't be, is your ROI with us 25, 50, 100, or 200%? You need to have the negative space, the zeros, so that can actually cancel out, right? So that's not, everyone is forced to choose some positive ROI. So I think in how you actually do this type of research and ask the questions is really important, because that is what is going to make it realistic at the end of the day, if people are just stuck. And clarifying that, the specificity of the question too, and what you're like, there's a lot of research design that goes into how you get the right answers. That's why research is such a massive field in every industry. So that I think is like the number one place to start with. You're never going to be able to handle every single like extra extraneous thing and use case. But at the end of the day, if you are doing it honestly, having honest research practices and getting an amount of people, then at that point, it should at least speak to some middle part of the bell curve, which is, I think, the most important part.
Yeah. I feel like that's the tension where you want to be honest and you want to give all the detail, but also you don't want your copy to suck. You know, like at a certain point, you want to be able to just say a stat rather than on average across a test of X amount of people, like that sort of thing. Mark, you have more thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that was a much better answer than I would have probably said. But the one thing that I was going to say that was more specific to our product is on the back end, you can apply like categories and tags and organize your proof points and evidence based on industry, based on company size, stage, role, use case, you name it. So I think to the specificity comment, like being able to try and find proof points that mimic the exact situation that you are currently in, or, you know, maybe if they are where you are trying to get to, I think helps tenfold just trying to find social proof that you can relate to and see yourself in versus, you know, the sales team using the same 5K studies for every single the conversation. And they're like, oh, trust me, like I promise this can work. And it's like, well, I don't really see myself in that proof point.
Yeah. That seems to be a thread in what I'm hearing you guys say is if you can have proof points that actually match an appropriate segment or someone who, if you had five customer segments and someone sees a proof point, it's like, oh, that's actually someone who looks like me, their business feels like mine, we're in a similar stage and they got this result. Even if that's more tedious and maybe less sexy of a number, it's just more helpful, more trustworthy.
Yeah. Specificity is everything, right? Especially in software where like differentiation for us is like, it's so much harder now with so many more products on the market, especially in MarTech, there was 14,000 different software vendors and every single piece of software now says we're easy to use. And like, what does that mean in a salesperson in a conversation? What does that mean for them? What does that mean in financial services and insurance, whatever their industry is they're selling into? Like that specificity, I think, is the first and arguably, other than honesty, like the most important step you can take to make it more useful.
Screen. So you're telling me, Alex, I'm not going to see easy to use on the user evidence website?
If you do, then I'm in trouble. Because
you're going to see AI-powered, all-in-one, every single buzzword that you can find from positioning, you'll find this on our site.
Supercharge your customer proof with the all-in-one testimonial platform.
AI-powered.
Well, guys, thank you. This was really fun to have you two on. I appreciate you. I mean, practicing what you preach insofar as just being honest about what you've been up to, user evidence, what's going well, and kind of where you've been learning. If people want to keep up with what you two are up to, where can they find you?
Yeah, follow Alex Eaton on LinkedIn so you can boost those follower numbers. But
boost that LinkedIn, follower count. Yeah.
LinkedIn, I would say head over to our website and subscribe to the newsletter that we just launched. We're sharing a lot of what's working, but more importantly, being honest about what's not working. And we're sharing stuff that we wouldn't necessarily post on LinkedIn. So there is some real gold that we're sharing over the coming weeks.
You should be adding. Yeah. And I think it would be unfair to not call out that the proof point is in my top three favorite podcasts right now. It's really good. So like anyone listening to this,
I appreciate that.
Thank you. At the risk of it, you stopping listening to this and exclusively listening to the proof point.
No.
I really think you guys are putting out really excellent content. So again, thanks, boys. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
This was a blast.
All right. Talk soon.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Thanks again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.